I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In a few minutes, the book one critic called the happiest, saddest, greatest book about rock and roll ever written. But first, hopes were raised today that the violence-torn nation of Kenya would find a political solution to the 6 weeks of bloodshed that followed a disputed election. Earlier today, an opposition lawmaker announced that President Mwai Kibaki and opposition leader Raila Odinga agreed to form a joint government. But former UN Chief Kofi Annan went on television soon after to say negotiators had jumped the gun, that word of an agreement was premature. Well, joining us on the line is Andrew Cawthorn. He's Kenya Bureau Chief for Reuters News Agency. Andrew, is there an agreement?
That's certainly what's being most widely speculated, but neither side has come out and confirmed that, nor has the mediator Kofi Annan. In fact, both sides are being far more tight-lipped than usual. However, the body language between them has improved considerably today than in recent days. So the speculation that a decent deal has been reached or is closer does seem to have some foundation, but we just cannot confirm exactly what the details of that are. However, it wouldn't be far-fetched to speculate that it is some sort of power-sharing arrangement, as most people really can't see any other solution than that to this crisis.
Is there some sense that leaders might have wanted to come to some sort of an agreement before a funeral that's scheduled for Saturday for an opposition lawmaker who was killed last week? We understand that people are very nervous about what kind of, you know, passions might be aroused around that funeral.
I don't think that's a factor. There are funerals taking place every day. This will be the second time a legislator has been shot. There are still some sporadic fighting going on in remote regions of Kenya. I think rather the triggers have been enormous international pressure, huge economic losses for Kenya, which are mounting every single day, and growing public pressure from Kenyans. And a factor here which some people overlooked is that there is a growing peace movement in Kenya.
Tell us more about that.
Well, basically, civil society groups, church groups, et cetera, are getting together. They're putting adverts in newspapers. They are flooding talk shows. They are putting a lot of pressure on their politicians. And they really are very angry with the politicians for having got them into this mess, because it is hitting people very hard. Unemployment is going up every single day. Thousands of people are being laid off. Ordinary people and rich people are losing a lot of money out of this crisis. Businesses have come to a standstill. 250,000 people are living as refugees in a country that is normally more used to receiving refugees. Interestingly, one of the biggest and perhaps most powerful pressure points on the government is from the business community. And that includes many influential and wealthy businessmen from President Kibaki's own Kikuyu tribe. And they are going to the government and the opposition through various different channels and telling them, sort this out very fast, or all the economic gains made in Kenya over the last 5 years are going to go up in smoke.
We understand there's been a lot of pressure from the U.S. as well, that the U.S. is threatening to bar Kenyan politicians or businessmen who may have played a role in the bloodshed from coming to the U.S. And U.S. Ambassador Michael Ranenberg said that, in fact, there were politicians paying for the violence. He suggested paying $60 to burn down a house.
It's a well-known fact that in Kenya, down the years, in fact, over the decades, politicians have generally been behind the violence at election time. During the election campaign, we saw money changing hands like nobody's business. I personally know a considerable number of Kenyans who happily boast of having been paid to go to certain regions and flush out members of opposing tribes or supporters of opposing parties. But in the last week or couple of weeks, the trouble seems to have got a little bit out of their hands. And I think that's what's really scared the political class here. They're actually going out, some of them hand in hand, opposition and government politicians together to communities, pleading for peace to try and calm the waters.
Andrew Cawthorn is Kenya Bureau Chief for Reuters News Agency. Andrew, thank you so much for your time.
My pleasure.
What a week in politics. Mitt Romney told a conservative group meeting in Washington he's out of the presidential race. Today, President Bush addressed the same group and said the GOP needs to hold on to the White House, but he never mentioned the now presumptive Republican nominee, John McCain. Well, today we thought we'd take a break from the campaign trail for a couple of minutes, and as we often do on Fridays, curl up with a good book. It also happens to hold a great suggestion for a Valentine's Day gift, and it gives us the opportunity to play some great music.
Won't you let me walk you home from school?
That's the song 13 by Big Star. It was playing at the Eastern Standard Bar in Charlottesville, Virginia in 1993 when Rob Sheffield met Renee Crist. They shared a few drinks and their love for Big Star and other bands. And Rob told Renee the same thing he told other girls, I'm going to make you a mixtape.
You're the kind of person that I always wanted to love.
A mixtape. Lou Reed. Right up against Freebird.
If I leave here tomorrow.
Into the Beach Boys. It's a way to woo love interests or maybe later break up with them. Big Star's 13 ultimately became Rob and Renee's wedding song, and in too short a time, those mixtapes also became a way for Rob to keep alive Renee's memory. She died unexpectedly at the age of 31. Well, now a contributing editor at Rolling Stone magazine, Rob Sheffield tells their story in his book, Love is a Mixtape, Life and Loss, One Song at a Time. It's out in paperback, a perfect opportunity for us to welcome Rob to our studios. Welcome.
Hey, thanks. Great to meet you.
Ay, ay, ay. I laughed. I cried. I sang out loud.
All right.
You know, as you guys did. In fact, you write that you and Renee, you know, this bittersweet notion, you had just 5 years. You didn't,
yeah.
You know. But on your 5th year anniversary, you didn't know what was coming. You went out and just belted out. Was it David Bowie?
Yeah, David Bowie. 5 years.
That's all we got. We got 5 years.
Let's go to the beginning first to find out who you guys were. You, a Catholic boy from here in Boston, Renee, a hell-raising Appalachian punk rocker.
I was really shy and retiring, and I was perfectly happy with the idea of hiding from life. And she was someone who was just really outspoken about things and passionate in a way that was totally new to me and, frankly, very scary to me.
You had nothing in common, really, but your love for music? Is that...
Yeah, books and music was pretty much it, you know.
Well, for instance, what? Like, what did you love? Look at each other and say, oh, my God, I can't believe you love that, too.
Their Replacements, a perfect example. You know, she was the biggest Replacements fan besides myself that I'd ever met. And we were constantly telling tales of Replacement shows that we'd seen because every Replacement show was so different from any other Replacement show. So we were constantly, like, amazed, you know, at those memories that we had in common. R.E.M. was a band that changed both of our lives and, you know, for her, that was something that she heard in the South, and she really identified because they were Southern boys. And that was a record I first heard. I checked it out at the Milton Public Library.
I thought you might also say Pavement.
Pavement kind of became, for us, there was lots of music that we'd heard for the first time and loved already, but this is the first time that we had a new favorite band together.
Go back to those cold sounds. And keep my advent to yourself, because it's nothing I don't like. Is it a crisis or a boring change? When it's central, so essential. It has a nice ring when you laugh at the low life.
Well, as we said, you and Renee married, lived like church mice. She sewed her clothes. You did some DJing. Your joy was mixtapes. You both made them for washing the dishes, walking the dog. But I want to go back to that first one you sent to woo her. Was there one song you were afraid to put on it?
Yeah, I have to admit, it was the song by Lucinda Williams called I Just Wanted to See You So Bad. I was so scared because it's such an obvious kind of song, you know? And I had put Bob Dylan's I Want You on the tape, and then I erased it because I was like, this is just too obvious. I'm trying to be subtle and devious here, but that Lucinda Williams song was so blatant. That was where I worried. I just want to see it so bad.
Well, and it worked. And besides, you know, falling in love with each other, you were so in love with your times. You sum this all up in a paragraph at the end of page 8. You know, you're talking about the 1990s. Do you mind reading that for us?
My pleasure. At the end of the working day, we rubbed each other's feet and sang Pavement songs to each other. And we knew every word was true, even the one that went, fruit-covered nails, electricity and lust. I rubbed Lubriderm into her pantyhose burns. The Reagan-Bush nightmare was coming to an end, so close we could taste it. Nirvana was all over the radio. Corporate rock was dead. On 90210, Dylan and Kelly were making out on the beach to Damn, I Wish I Was Your Lover. We were young and in love, and the world was changing.
You write later, so full of music, it seemed we'd never run out. 'Twas bliss in that dawn to be alive, but to be young and overworked and underexposed and stuck in a nowhere town was very heaven. And then, what happened?
Well, she had a pulmonary embolism very suddenly, very unexpectedly. It was just a fluke thing. It was May 1997. It was a Sunday afternoon, and it just totally came out of the blue. And that was just really shocking, and it was shocking for all of us who loved her. It just didn't make any sense.
You were right there, and boom, over before you knew it. And yet the night before... You know, you write about how you stayed up all night. You remember every single CD you played while she sat at the sewing machine. Can you remember some of them now?
Yeah, I sure can. There was the first two REM albums, Murmur and Reckoning. There was the first DB's album. There was the first Liz Phair album. There was
Exile in Guyville?
Yeah. There was Marshall Crenshaw and the Dream Syndicate and Dean Martin and Yola Tango. All this different stuff that we were listening to at the time. And she just kept, she was sitting at the sewing machine. She would just like call out, you know, the next CD that she wanted me to put on, or I would put something on, and, and we just kept slapping them on all night.
Paul Revere and the Raiders, the Dream Syndicate, Everything But the Girl, Buddy Holly. And you went to sleep to Dean Martin?
Yeah.
Everybody finds somebody someplace. There's no telling where love may appear.
And as we said, the next day Renee died. Well, Rob Sheffield's book about his time with Renee and about the culture of mixtapes in the late 80s and 90s is called Love is a Mixtape. After the break, what happened to the music after Renee died? A quick reminder also later in the program, the BBC's Owen Bennett Jones. We'll be back in 1 minute here and now.
I'd arrange for every girl to have your chance.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.
Love, love, love makes me do foolish things.
That's Martha and the Vandellas' Love Makes Me Do Foolish Things, one of the thousands of songs our guest Rob Sheffield shared with Renee Crist through the mixtapes they made for each other during their 5 years together until her sudden death from a pulmonary embolism at the age of 31. Rob took their passion for music and turned it into a career. He's contributing editor for Rolling Stone magazine. Wouldn't Renee be proud? He lists all of their mixtapes and tells the story of their love and the history of music in the 1990s in his book, Love is a Mixtape. So, Rob, what happens after Renee's death? I mean, you not only lost her, but you almost lost, you know, a lot of the music.
The grief process is just a very long and slow one. And very difficult. It was hard to predict which music I would be able to listen to because it would make me feel closer to her, and which music just became too hard to listen to because it was too full of memories.
You write about, for instance, driving along and hearing George Jones, he just stopped loving her today, and you have to pull off the road.
Yeah.
You had to relearn how to listen to music, you write.
Yeah, that seems totally true.
Yeah.
It was a matter of learning to do something by myself that I really learned to do with her.
Are there songs that are on those mixtapes that you just can't listen to anymore? I'm thinking of Sleater Kinney's One More Hour.
Yeah. That'll always be a hard song to listen to. It's funny, I was interviewing the band a few years ago, and I was talking with the guitarist, Gary Brownstein, and I just mentioned that that was one of my favorite songs, but it was just so sad. And she just suddenly got so sad, and she was like, that is such a sad song. She's like, it makes me sad to play it, but, it reminds me of sad times in my life. And it's funny that, we both bonded over what a devastating and powerful and beautiful song it was.
They're
all in my shelves. None of them ever got taped over or thrown away or anything like that, or put in storage or anything like that. The tapes are always with me.
Is it the same now? I mean, we should say there's a lovely ending to your story, which is that you managed
very happy.
You met another wonderful woman who also has this incredible taste in music.
Yes.
Now it's CD mixes. But is it the same, a CD and a mixtape, a tape that you switch sides and all that?
Well, it's funny. A CD mix is so great. I love how fast they are to make, how easy they are to make, how convenient it is. I love how before you make it, you know whether it's going to fit and you can fiddle with the order. But there's something about the physical presence of the mixtape, of the cassette. You're picking out the songs for side one and side two, and you pick out the slow song at the end of side one, then the really powerhouse song at the start of side two, and the really short songs to fill up space at the end of the tape, and thinking of titles for side one and versus titles for side two. And there's definitely like an art to it, and definitely like something about the mixtape that is very special to the cassette.
Don't play that song for me.
In addition to the love of mixtapes and realizing that mixtapes are love, when you give one, it's such a gift. There's a chapter called Jackie Blue in the book. It's about Jacqueline Kennedy.
Yes.
And among, Renee's wonderful phantasmagoric fashion statements was a pink pillbox hat that she had.
Yeah.
And you found a recording of a newsreel that was played in movie theaters in which Jackie Kennedy thanks the American people for their sympathy after the death of her husband. Let's just listen to a little bit of that.
I want to take this opportunity to express my appreciation for the hundreds of thousands of messages, nearly 800,000 in all, which my children and I have received over the past few weeks. The knowledge of the affection in which my husband was held by all of you has sustained me, and the warmth of these tributes is something I shall never forget.
And you said in listening to this, the whole book is about songs. You heard this as a rock and roll song.
Yeah, definitely. There's a certain rock and roll edge of desperation to it. There's a certain rock and roll emotional intensity to it. That really strange part in that recording where she says, it is really my greatest wish that these letters get acknowledged, and I will when I have time.
It is my greatest wish that all of these letters be acknowledged. They will be, but it will take a long time to do so. But I know you will understand.
It's really a sad and powerful thing for her to say, but that's something that I think people who've gone through a process of grieving can identify with, that you're so dependent on the kindnesses of people around you, and you're really kind of powerless to repay the debts of gratitude that you feel to those people who helped pull you through. Mm-hmm.
In the very last paragraph of your book and the acknowledgments, you mentioned that your favorite song now is International Airport by the group Dump.
Yes.
Okay.
I love them.
This is the one you put on mixtapes. Some of us can identify with this. Mixtapes are also about imposing our will about music on other people. Like, you must listen to this. What is it about this song that you like?
I don't know, but it's funny. I never make any converts with this song, partly because it's about 13 minutes long, and most of it is this droning guitar instrumental intro. And it's funny that I never put this on a tape for somebody and have them say, yeah, I really love that song, International Airport. It's usually a song that I suspect people pretty much fast forward over, but darn it, I love that song.
Well, wait a minute. Does your wife love it too?
I think she loves it because I love it.
But that's love. There.
Exactly. Exactly. Oh, believe me. If you can like put up with like a 13-minute droning guitar instrumental, that is definitely love. That is definitely the real thing.
Rob Sheffield, contributing editor at Rolling Stone magazine. His book, Love is a Mixtape, Life and Loss, One Song at a Time, is now out in paperback. Rob, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you so much. So great to meet you.
Still ahead today, when Leno and Letterman were on the other side of the picket line, we'll let you listen to Dump. Back after the latest news, here and now. The late Benazir Bhutto's Pakistan People's Party is publicly rejecting a Scotland Yard investigation into the former Prime Minister's death. Scotland Yard has concluded that Bhutto died from the effects of a bomb blast, not gunshots, confirming President Pervez Musharraf's own investigation. Bhutto died while riding in a caravan on December 27th. She was waving to supporters through her vehicle's sunroof when an attacker first fired shots and then blew himself up. For more on what's really going on in Pakistan, we welcome the BBC's Owen Bennett-Jones. Owen, first of all, remind us why it matters so much exactly how Bhutto died.
Well, there's been a controversy about this from the very moment of her death, really. The people who were with her, Pakistan People Party activists and leaders, say that she was shot, and that's what they thought. And some of them, I mean, I spoke to these people, and some of them bathed her body, so you'd think they would know, and they said there were gunshot wounds. But the government came out very quickly saying that they thought she had knocked her head against the sunroof. And I think that very phrase was part of the problem, because it made it sound like it was some sort of trivial accident, and as if they were playing down Benazir Bhutto's death. So the party reacted very strongly to that and rejected it and so on. And they eventually got Scotland Yard in to give a neutral view. And the Scotland Yard view is pretty unambiguous. I've read the report, and it is basically saying the government was right.
And again, it matters to Bhutto's followers, because they feel if there was some sort of high-powered weapon involved, that perhaps the government might have been involved in Bhutto's death?
Well, maybe. I think, actually, when you sit down with these people and really talk them through it, which, again, I've done, they're not really saying that. If you actually discuss it properly, rationally, and not in the context of a political rally or something, they will say that, you know, it doesn't really make much difference, this whole issue, as to whether she died from a bullet or from a bomb. The point is that some militant killed her, and for a pretty obvious reason, that she was speaking out against the militants. Now, you can then ask the next question, which is, did the government control the militant? The government absolutely rejects it. And to be perfectly honest, I don't think many in the Pakistan People's Party, at least at the senior levels, really believe that the General Musharraf had anything to do with it. General Musharraf's authorities were warning Benazir Bhutto about these threats, telling her not to go to these rallies. And I think there is an understanding, really, amongst the senior echelons of the party anyway, that it wasn't in his interest to see her killed.
Well, we want to go on and talk about what's happening in Pakistan now, but just a little bit more about the Scotland Yard investigation, because the criticism was that the area had been cleaned and her body was not exhumed. So what was the evidence that the Scotland Yard used for their report?
Just quickly on those, because this is the sort of thing that happens and it leads to all sorts of conspiracy theories, but the fact is that crime scenes in Pakistan are always hosed down. Now, I say that with one reservation. When they tried to kill General Musharraf, the guy who was running the ISI at that time, the intelligence agency, Mr. Kiani, General Kiani, who's now running the army, he did actually order a proper lockdown of the whole area, and it worked. They got a mobile phone chip, which enabled them to unravel the plot against Musharraf. So there was a double standard there, if you like. But in general terms, whenever there's a crime in Pakistan in a public place, they wash it down because they want to get the traffic moving. That's how it works. There was nothing particularly unusual about that. And that's the kind of problem you get. The autopsy. They asked Asif Zardari, her husband, do you want an autopsy? He said no. And then it becomes a government conspiracy to deny an autopsy. So, you know, you can see how the false impressions build up.
Right. And yet there were x-rays, and we understand that Scotland Yard looked at those x-rays of Benazir Bhutto's head to come to their conclusion.
Yeah, the evidence they had was the x-ray, and they talked to some of these PPP leaders, you know, which is a bit baffling because I'm telling you, they say they bathed the body and there were gunshot wounds. The report here from Scotland Yard says we talked to these people and there are no gunshot wounds. I don't know quite how they've reached that conclusion. They also had the pictures. And I must say, having seen the pictures, and there were quite a few because people were taking images of this on their video phones, and then they handed them into the commercial TV station. So the TV stations gathered quite a few of these images, and I've seen them. And I, having looked at them very closely, I thought she was shot, to be honest, because you could see the headscarf sort of moving and then her dropping to the ground. It looked to me as if she was shot. But, you know, you have to accept these Scotland Yard people have looked at those pictures, they've looked at the x-rays, they've spoken to the doctors, they've spoken to the PPP activists, and they're saying pretty unambiguously she died as a result of a suicide bomb.
Well, you know, we were talking about what matters here. The Pakistani government has also announced arrests, people accused in the death of Benazir Bhutto. Does that matter?
Of course that matters, but, you know, no one will trust it. A few weeks ago, they said they'd got hold of a 14-year-old boy who was meant to be the backup suicide bomber. You know, maybe. But no one trusts the investigations. No one will see a process, a fair, open trial in which these people will be presented with evidence at a proper court. You know, it never sort of works like that. The militants have been able to act not only against Benazir Bhutto, but also launching something like 60 suicide bombs last year, capturing soldiers, killing police, killing civilians with impunity. And it happens time and time again, and they walk away. And so if it is possible for some of these cases to be resolved and for some of these people to be brought to justice, that surely must be a positive step.
What is Pervez Musharraf's standing now?
Well, he's lost a lot of ground. I mean, since he's tried to sack the Supreme Court Chief Justice back in February, almost a year ago now, he's been on the slide in the polls and he has lost a lot of authority. He's hoping these elections he'll be able to manage the post-election situation in such a way as to restore his fortune somewhat. And it may work out like that if there's no overall majority for any one party. That will sort of help Musharraf do a bit of divide and rule, as it were. But in general terms, he is far weaker than he was a year ago. And most of the people who follow Pakistan politics closely think he'll have to go quite soon.
Well, and the elections are scheduled for February 18th. How is this report likely to affect the elections?
The big picture is that the death of Benazir Bhutto has changed the election situation in this way. Before her death, there was talk of a fixed result in favour of the party that supports General Musharraf. There was such anger at Benazir Bhutto's death that any PMLQ, this is the party that supports Musharraf, majority, would be met with a very angry response. And the establishment clearly know it. So it's much more likely that there will now be a result which gives no overall majority to anyone. And it may be that the Pakistan People's Party, Benazir's party, gets the prime ministership. So in that sense, her death will have delivered a sympathy vote, but also an understanding amongst those who try to manipulate results in Pakistan that there's a limit to what they can do.
Are you saying there will be a power-sharing agreement?
That seems likely. That's the most likely outcome of these elections, that no one party will get an overall majority, that there will be a coalition put together after the election and some sort of coalition government.
Well, we've been looking ahead, but I'm just wondering, is it still shocking to people that Benazir Bhutto is gone?
Well, it is shocking to Pakistanis, but they're used to so much violence in their public life that, you know, I think it would be, you know, they get over it more quickly than people in the West would in a similar situation. They are used to very traumatic events. And don't forget, there is now a suicide bomb every week in Pakistan, and many, many people are dying. Hundreds have been killed in these attacks. So, you know, there is a certain weary acceptance that this is how Pakistan politics works.
The BBC's Owen Bennett-Jones. Owen, thanks so much for speaking to us.
Thank you very much.
Quick look ahead. Monday on Here and Now, analyst Andrew Bacevich. He calls the military surge in Iraq the surge to nowhere. That's Monday. You're listening to Here and Now. A deal could be in the works that would end the four-month writer's strike this weekend. The strike stopped production of most TV shows, but David Letterman owns his production company and made his own deal with the Writers Guild. And Jay Leno is writing his own jokes. Well, today, Leno and Letterman are on the other side of the picket line, but nearly 30 years ago, they walked that line during the Comedy Store strike of 1979. Richard Zoglin writes about that in his new book, Comedy at the Edge, How Stand-Up in the 1970s Changed America. He joins us from the NPR studios in New York. Richard, welcome.
Great to be here. Hi.
And take us back to, for those who weren't there, to 279. What was the Comedy Store?
The Comedy Store was the most popular comedy club in Los Angeles. All the young comedians in LA would work out there every night, and they would work on their material and try to get noticed by the agents and the bookers for The Tonight Show, and they worked for nothing because it was considered a workshop, and it was run by Mitzi Shore. She felt like she was bringing along these young comedians, and she didn't feel that she had to pay them, and they were willing to work for nothing because they knew they were getting a big break in the business.
Well, and let's listen to some of what, you know, as you said, was heard at this training ground. Comics like Richard Pryor, Robin Williams, Leno, Letterman. Here's Letterman performing a bit about Kentucky Fried Chicken at the Comedy Store in the 70s.
Last couple years, Colonel Sanders has been selling ribs. Who wants to eat chicken ribs, anyway, you know? One of these days you'll be hearing, yes, the colonel has beaks.
And now Letterman is one who said he was indebted to Mitzi Shore at the time. She really took him and his wife at the time in.
In 1975, he drove out from Indianapolis, and Mitzi Shore really liked him, made him an MC very early on. The big comic at the time was actually Jay Leno. Dave actually looked up to Jay and modeled himself a little bit after Jay.
Well, if they all agreed to this arrangement that they would work for free in the hopes of getting bigger jobs, what happened?
They realized that they were making a lot of money for Mitzi Shore at the Comedy Store, and they just decided it was unfair that they should get paid.
Well, describe the strike at the time. I mean, these are real, you know, comics and comic writers out on a picket line. What did some of the signs say?
The yuck stops here, no money, no funny. And the comics argued, I mean, give us a little bit of money, you know, $25 a set or something. At least we can, you know, buy a little food. Even David Letterman, the night that he was guest hosting The Tonight Show, after the show, came down to the store and joined the picket line.
Now
that was a big blow to Mitzi Shore, who felt sort of betrayed by Dave.
This was very painful for a lot of these people. But at one point, she made sort of a compromise offer of $25 a set on weekends. And so, you write that some of the comics, Gary Shandling is one, crossed back over the line and went to work.
Gary Shandling was the biggest name to go across the picket line. He was considered one of the really best people at the club at that time. But a lot of the people were really unhappy with Gary. Tensions began to build between the strikers and the non-strikers. One night, one of the loyalists to Mitzi Shore actually drove a car into the picket line, knocked over Jay Leno. People thought he was really injured. He wasn't. They took him off to the hospital anyway. Right after that, they came to a settlement because they decided things had gotten a little too out of hand.
Well, now tell us the settlement.
It was $25 a set on the weekdays and weekends. It seems so piddly, but that was a symbolic breakthrough for the comedians.
And well, not only that, and for comedy clubs.
Comics in New York saw that settlement, and then they went to the club owners in New York and basically got the same kind of settlement in New York without a strike. And this launched the comedy club boom of the 80s. And the interesting thing is that both Jay and Dave were very strong labor guys in that Comedy Store strike of 79, and so they were in a very difficult position when this latest writer strike came along, because I think they're very sympathetic with the writers, and yet they had non-writing staffers that if they didn't go back to work, those people would be laid off.
Well, and do you see some irony in that Jay Leno in particular, who's putting his show on and writing his own material, is angering, you know, the Writers Guild in doing that. He, as you said, he's torn because he's got other staff he wants to keep going. But here's the guy who was flat on his back at a, you know, on a picket line, actually faking that he had a worse injury than he had after he was bumped by this car. But he was on the other side.
Yeah, and I'm sure it pains him a little bit, but he is a guy who can't stand not to be working.
Richard Zoglin, writer and editor at Time Magazine. His new book is Comedy at the Edge, How Stand-Up in the 1970s Changed America. Richard, thanks for speaking with us.
Okay, great to be with you.
And after a quick break, Lorena McKennitt, Around the World in One CD. That's in 1 minute here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Canadian singer-songwriter Lorena McKennitt released her first CD in almost a decade over a year ago, and now it's up for a Grammy for Best Contemporary World Music Album. That's a genre she's comfortable in. She's sold millions of records worldwide with music informed by her Celtic roots. The Mummer's Dance was a radio hit in 1998. Here's the live version from the CD Nights from the Alhambra.
When in the springtime of the year, when the trees are crowned with leaves, when the ashen oak and the birchen hue are dressed in ribbons fair.
Well, Lorena McKennitt's latest CD is An Ancient Muse. It takes her to many shores, including Turkey's.
See the, past the far off hill, tower held in the sky.
That's The Gates of Istanbul from An Ancient Muse, and Lorena McKennitt joins us in the studio. Welcome.
Thank you.
And congratulations.
Thank you very much.
And we read that the inspiration for this CD was a trip along the Silk Road. Where did you go?
Well, it was heading in that direction. I discovered in 91 that the Celts were much more than this mad collection of anarchists from Ireland, Scotland and Wales and so on. But they're actually this vast collection of tribes that had fanned out across Europe and well into Asia Minor. So my travels actually took me to Eastern Europe, to Greece, to Turkey, to Mongolia and China.
Well, you can hear those sounds on, as we heard, The Gates of Istanbul, or Karvansaray. Let's listen.
This glancing life is like a morning star, a setting sun or rolling waves at sea, a gentle breeze or lightning in a storm, a dancing dream of all eternity.
If you could just tick through the instruments that made their way onto this CD.
Well, I began certainly with one of the harps that are the instruments that I'm known for, which is the harp and then the piano. Then wove out from there guitars, ouds, dumbeks, which are a percussion instrument. There's one instrument that's called a lyra that comes from Greece. It's a little bowed instrument, and you play it, it's held in your lap. It's a very Eastern voice, and I really wanted to bring this Celtic history more to the East, and this was an instrument to do that by.
Can we hear that in Penelope? Song?
Well, in actual fact, Penelope's song has another instrument called a nicoharpa that comes from Scandinavia.
Well, let's listen to a little Penelope song and hear that sound.
Now that the time has come, soon gone is the day, there upon some distant shore.
Organizing all of this is your own record company, Quinlan Road, your label. You oversee the day-to-day operations. First of all, why do that?
Well, it evolved out of default when I began this part of my recording career in the 80s, I couldn't even name the record companies, much less know how to reach them. So I just took charge of my career. And when major record companies came into the picture, there was all of the discussion about bringing on board a traditional manager. But some of the managers that I spoke with, we really couldn't find a modality that was going to work for us. So by default, I ended up building my own business infrastructure.
Most people are very selective. They find their music where they want it online. Mm-hmm. It's not getting delivered to them by the old systems, mm-hmm. the old delivery systems, and you're perfectly positioned for the people who love your music to go right and get it where they know that it is.
Well, I'm hopeful that's the case. It's quite a topical note that you've observed there, because there's no question the music industry is in a severe state of collapse. So we're presently in the process of redefining our business model.
How do you feel you? What do you feel you have to do?
Well, I think the basics of business practices, you know, you treat your public with courtesy, you deliver good customer service. People like to have the liner notes, and so they are trying to find the CDs. So we're trying to assist people, but also allowing them, if they prefer to download the music, to do that simply and in a way they can trust the method of doing that, and they get good value.
Yeah. Let's listen to a little more of what they might get. What would you like us to play from your CD?
Never Ending Road, perhaps.
Never Ending Road, let's listen.
The road now leads onward as far as can be. Winding lanes and hedgerows and threes.
What is this a story of?
Well, it's kind of a metaphorical approach to life and learning. It parallels my own path of discovery, because I've used my career as a method of self-education, and that I really compare the process more to an act of travel writing than reaching towards finished piece of art.
Well, and that brings us to a question we've wanted to ask you. You know, where does a certain part of the journey fit into the music? I know you know what I'm talking about. I'd been wondering, 9 years between CDs, and I had no idea until I went to your website and read your very frank accounts that you've been involved in a very long lawsuit. First of all, I'm very sorry to hear that you lost your fiancé in a boating accident.
Thank you.
And then got involved in an awful lawsuit against a former friend who wrote a tell-all book about you.
Well, I think it was a very landmark human rights case that was to do with privacy. Mm-hmm. In this particular situation, this individual who I'd had a falling out with chose, I guess, as an act of revenge to invade my privacy. So, for example, in the book, she described in great detail my bereavement at the time of the passing of my fiancé. But I think the good news is that it did become a landmark human rights case.
In Britain, in particular.
In Britain, yes.
Went to the highest court there.
Yes, it was endorsed by the House of Lords, and now we are seeing it having impact the world over, that just because a person might be well-known doesn't mean that they still don't have the innate need for privacy.
That's because you won the case, and the appeal from your former friend who wrote the tell-all was denied. But what do you say about the American celebrities who seek the camera, then complain when they have a misstep and the camera's there?
I think the media, and particularly the commercial media, needs to remind itself it has control over that stage, and they do not have to. I've never heard of an editor with a gun to their head saying, I have to cover that shot of Britney Spears getting loaded into an ambulance or whatever. Mm. But I think it's a fascinating issue, because I think now with the convergence, let's say, of cameras and the internet, that the great pressure on private lives that are of people that are well known, now it's coming more closer to people who are anonymous. And I think we're very, very close to the average anonymous person feeling a great threat on their private life.
Well, you just never know what you're going to end up talking
about
when someone comes in. That is Canadian singer-songwriter Lorena McKennitt. We have been speaking about world music,
yes,
because
yes.
Her CD, An Ancient Muse, is up for a Grammy this Sunday for Best Contemporary World Album. Thank you for talking to us about that and so much more.
Oh, thank you. It's been a great pleasure.
Here Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Have a great weekend, and please join us again here and now.